Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Elliott Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. The so-called Scottsboro trials, which almost spanned the 1930s, were a watershed in American justice and in the history of race relations. It's the third historical crux point that Ellen Feldman has approached with insightful fiction, following the lives of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Lucy Mercer in Lucy, and the Holocaust and its aftermath in The Boy Who Loved Anne Frank. In this case, both thoughtful readers and critics have agreed that Scottsboro finds literary excellence in a difficult period. Reviewers are calling it... Wow! It's a magical sound surrounding the points from reviews I was going to mention. So perhaps I'll pause and remind you that library policy asks that you turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices that make any kind of noise anywhere in the building past the entry hall. We appreciate it. Anyway, reviews are calling Scottsboro a riveting drama, emotionally charged, powerful, spellbinding fiction, subtle, deft, stylish, a page-turner, gripping, masterful, compelling, and still timely, brings an American disgrace to life with eloquence, intelligence, and passion, and, my favorite, the comment, Ruby is a gem of a character and belongs with the best of William Faulkner's or Alice Walker's women. To tell us more about this book and the historical upheaval that provoked it, I'm proud to introduce a great writer and a great friend to this institution, Ellen Feldman.
Thank you, Sarah. Sarah did not come to those quotes by accident. Someone fed them to her. But thank you, Sarah. Thank you, all members of the library. The staff of this library, as all of you here know, it's just fabulous. And those of us who work here and write here would have a much grimmer time of it. And I think turn out less worthy books without them. They're all wonderful, so thank you. And thank you all for coming out tonight on this lovely night. I'm going to talk a bit about Scottsboro, the case and the book, and then I'm going to read for just 6 minutes for those of you who get impatient with reading, and then you can have at me with comments and questions and whatnot. I'd like to tell you an anecdote about something that happened to me repeatedly during the approximately 3 years I was working on this book. If you're a novelist, frequently people say, "What are you working on now?" And whenever I said Scottsboro, I had the same reaction. Terrific. And then there'd be a beat. And unless the person was an historian, they'd say, "Refresh my memory. What was that about again?" Scottsboro is iconic in American lore. Everybody knows what it's about, that it was a terrible case of racial injustice. Few people know the details of what actually happened, how deeply it convulsed the nation, and how it reverberated around the entire world, especially in Western Europe. It also incited and exacerbated other prejudices of the day. The isms ran rampant. There was racism, obviously. There was sexism. There was anti-Semitism. And there was communism. Scottsboro is important, therefore, not only in its own right, but also in what it tells us about America and its fault lines during a good part of the 20th century. It dragged on for almost 50 years. The original incident happened in 1931, and he was known as the last of the Scottsboro boys. The only one who lived to be pardoned was pardoned in 1976. So that was a long and terrible and very shameful incident ongoing incident in our history. For those of you who don't know the story, let me refresh your memory. It started on March 25th, 1931. The Depression was deepening. Hoover was still in the White House. The New Deal was not even an idea in Franklin Roosevelt. Not only was he not in the White House, he hadn't even thought of anything like the New Deal. About a quarter of the population was trying to live without any income at all, and 200,000 young people under the age of 20 were hoboing around the countryside looking for a job or some food or the good time that was supposed to be the birthright of young people. And a bunch of them, both black and white youngsters, hopped a freight train going from Chattanooga, Tennessee, through Huntsville, Alabama, and on. And as the tale was always told in accounts of the time, a white foot came down on a black hand. What happened is it was a nice spring day, and the young men were fooling around and swinging off the cars and on, and one of the white youths walked down the car and stepped on the hand of a black youth who was hanging off it. And it could have been an accident, people thought, or the boys thought. And then he walked back and stepped on the hand again, and obviously this was not an accident. A fight broke out. The black youths ended up throwing the whites from the train. The white boys went to the next station and complained. A posse quickly was formed, obviously a white posse. They stopped the train at Paint Rock, the next station, and rounded up 9 young black youths they found in the various cars. They had no proof that these boys had done anything. They just rounded them up. Then they found 2 girls in men's overalls on the train in one of the cars. And then the story got really good from their point of view, because this was 1931 Alabama. These white men were convinced that black men could not possibly be in the presence of white women without raping them. Now, whether the posse cried rape first or the girls did is unclear. I made a choice, a fictional choice for this, but we really don't know. We do know that the girls were, at least one of the girls was smart enough to know that she could be arrested for vagrancy and crossing state lines with men who were not her relatives. So they did, in fact, cry rape. And they rounded up the boys, as I said, and took them to the county seat, Scottsboro. And then a lynch mob formed immediately. But fortunately, the sheriff called out the National Guard, and the weather turned cool, so apparently lynching is not as pleasant in cold weather. However, illegal lynching followed. In 4 days, the state of Alabama tried, and with grossly inadequate defense counsel. There were 2 local lawyers. They were probably drunk for most of the trial, and they did not meet the young men before they defended them. In 4 days, the state convicted, and sentenced to death 8 of the 9 young men. The only reason the 9th was not convicted and sentenced to death is that some, but not all, of the jury members decided that 13 was too young to be sentenced to the electric chair. And they ranged in age from 13 to 19. They were all very young. The 13-year-old who was not convicted had never left home before. He had hopped this freight train with his older brother, his first time away from home, and he ended up in this. At first, the incident didn't attract much attention beyond the immediate South. But then, as the news of this, the rush to justice or the injustice became widely known, the Scottsboro case became a cause. No crime in America, let alone a crime that was not convicted, resulted in as many trials, convictions, reversals, retrials, and Supreme Court decisions, including a seminal 1935 decision. Collectively, the 9 young men spent more than 100 years in some of the worst prisons and jails of Depression-era Alabama. As I said, only one of them lived to be pardoned. And that was in 1976, because George Wallace, thanks to the Voting Rights Act, there were 400,000 new voters, and they were black in the state of Alabama, so he decided to pardon him. The book begins with 3 quotations that address the issues of the day, and I'd like to read those. The first is from Clarence Norris, the man who was pardoned, who became known as the last of the Scottsboro boys. I was scared before, but it wasn't nothing to how I felt now. I knew that if a white woman accused a black man of rape, he was as good as dead, and that was true at the time. The second is from Langston Hughes, the renowned African-American poet, but this was in 1931. Who ever heard of raping a prostitute? And the third is from one of the prosecutors wrapping up in the second set of trials. I said there were many, many sets of trials in this. And he was wrapping up for the state in this set of trials. Is justice going to be bought and sold in Alabama with Jew money from New York? Now, surprisingly, a mistrial was not declared. As for those isms that the quotes reflect, the Scottsboro, of course, was first and foremost about racism. The fact that the lynching did not occur the first night is really pretty amazing. There were many, many lynchings at the time, and they were social occasions. The library has a new book which is called Lynching Photographs, and it's pretty grim, and most of you have probably seen some of this sort of thing. It wasn't just poor people, farmers, but this was a family outing. One of the worst postcards I've ever seen is of a nice-looking gentleman in a white suit and a Panama hat and a little girl in her Sunday best and Mary Janes looking up at a black body hanging from a tree. And so the North was absolutely convinced with good cause, that these young men did not stand a chance. One of the congressmen from Alabama, George Huddleston, who was known as a liberal, and in fact was a liberal in many ways, went on record as saying, "I don't care if the boys are black or are in it, were, black is the point, were guilty or innocent. They were found riding in a freight car with white girls. They were not, in fact, but he said that, and therefore they deserve to go to the electric chair as soon as possible." So, as from his point of view, riding in a freight car with white women was a capital offense in the state of Alabama. As I said, many in the North, once they got wind of what was happening, began to organize. And this happened both in this country and in Europe, as I said. Einstein and Thomas Mann wrote letters. Here in New York, Theodore Dreiser organized a committee, began holding fundraising events. Nancy Kennard and Kay Boyle sent money to the boys. And they, in fact, did. The Communist Party was the most important actor here, which is funny because these days, and we can go into this later if anybody has questions, these days when people talk about the Scottsboro case, they don't mention the Communist Party. They ascribe the helping of the boys, the saving of the boys, to the NAACP. It's not true. The Communist Party saved those boys from the electric chair several times around. Which is not to suggest the Communist Party didn't have political motives behind all this. The lawyers really wanted to save the boys, but the Communist Party also knew this was a wonderful recruiting technique, recruiting cause. And in fact, a line went around at the time: if you were a recruiter for the Communist Party, which would you rather have, 9 new black members or 9 dead black martyrs? And so a lot of people in the party thought this was a very useful cause. All this agitation in the North hurt as well. It helped the boys in that it kept the appeals going, but it hurt the climate of opinion in the South, which is to say that it's possible that these young men would have been sentenced to life in prison the second or third time around rather than repeatedly to the electric chair without the Northerners agitating. Now, whether that's better or worse is not clear. The man who was always thought of as the head of the Scottsboro Boys, the leader, and he wasn't, because 4 of the boys knew each other before they hopped the train. The others didn't know each other at all. Haywood Patterson, but he was the smartest and he was the angriest and I think the bravest in many ways. And so he was known as the leader, and he said, I don't want life in prison. I'd rather go to the electric chair than spend my life in prison for a crime I didn't commit. But as I said, the interesting thing, the agitation in the North and the anger at this agitation in the South created a kind of revival of the Civil War. And the New York Times in June 1931 wrote an interesting article saying, while many in the North believe that those in the South want to lynch these boys or electrocute these boys simply because they're black, many in the South are convinced that many in the North want to save them, whether they're guilty or innocent, simply because they're black. And in fact, there was question whether these boys were innocent, partly because some of them didn't confess that they had done raped it, but they fingered the others, and probably they were beaten and threatened by the sheriff. I mean, there is some indication of that. But it gave pause in the North. Even most Northern liberals assumed that sex had occurred on the train, but that it had been consensual sex. In case I didn't make it clear, it didn't. Most of the boys had not seen these two girls on the train. In other words, if Southerners believed that black men could not be in the presence of white women without raping them, Northerners believed, and probably Southerners didn't, but there was a mitigating circumstance here, that women of easy virtue could not be anywhere without trying to ply their trade. And so the situation turned sexual politics on its head. You had the Northern liberals who normally would have seen these two young women mill workers and part-time prostitutes, because that was the only way they could make ends meet. The mill wages were so low in Depression-era Alabama, and semi-literate. You had the Northern liberals who normally would have seen them as victims of economic and social injustice and probably tried to unionize them in the bargain, saying, those two tramps, you know, look what they're doing, they're awful, they got what they deserved. Not they got what they deserved, they weren't raped, but look how terrible they are. And the interesting thing is that a saying was going around at the time, those young men are going to fry for what they could have had for 2 bits. So much for kind of an enlightened mind in the North. And that is Langston Hughes' comment. You can't rape a prostitute. A prostitute just wants sex. Ruby Bates and Victoria Price were the two girls' names. As I said, they were part-time prostitutes. There was no other way they could survive. Victoria was the older and the smarter of the two. She was very, very quick-witted. She was very confident. She, in fact, wrapped or outmaneuvered Samuel Leibowitz, who is an ace criminal defense lawyer, and we'll get to him shortly, who went down there to defend the boys the second round of trials. He had won 77 out of 78 first-degree murder cases with one hung jury, and he thought this would be a piece of cake. Well, as I said, we'll get to that. But Victoria Price manipulated him with her feigned naivete and stupidity, even. Leibowitz was down there. He was paying his own expenses. He was not getting paid for this, and even paying his own expenses. And he had Lionel Trains make a mock-up of the train, a small train, 30-some feet, a model, on which the rape did not happen. It was accurate down to the brass fittings, because he wanted to show they couldn't possibly have been in the proper cars at the time and everything. And he said to Victoria Price in the courtroom when he had her on the stand, "Is this a fair representation of the train you were on?" And she said, "No." He said, "In what way does it differ?" Because here he's got the entire Lionel company working to make this beautiful train that all the reporters loved. And she said, "Oh, that little thing is just a toy." Well, of course, the Southern courtroom went wild. You know, one of their own had bettered the Jew lawyer from New York. She also was a fabulous actress. She held the audience, because they were an audience, they were really responding and crying out, "You tell them," and "Amen," and stuff, in this courtroom, spellbound with her very racy — they're racy for now, they were extremely racy for those days — testimony of her rape. And in fact, no women except two women reporters were permitted in the courtroom because it was so racy, and no men under 21. So there were other men were standing in line at 5 o'clock in the morning to get in for this wonderful thing. And she would tell them the terrible things that — and she made up wonderful stories about what they said as they raped her. And then she sat in the courtroom and she pointed them out. "There yonder sits the man who raped me. There yonder sits the man who ruined my life," and this sort of thing. Then Ruby took the stand. Ruby was terrified, shy, probably not too bright. And she couldn't identify anybody. This was not a lineup. This was just — she sees these young men sitting in the dock, and she cannot bring herself to say they raped her. She just kind of, "Well, all I know is I was raped." Actually, she used another term, which also enjoyed some, or led to some hilarity in the North. "I don't know who raped me. I just know an intercourse was held with me." So that went around for a while too. And but however, Ruby had either a fear of damnation, conscience, a fear of damnation, an overpowering yen for a young man named Earl Streeter, or a combination of all of them, because she wrote a letter to Earl Streeter 9 months after the event saying, "Those boys did not rape me. I was not raped on that train." One of the reasons probably is that Earl was leaving her, and she wanted to tell him that she was a good woman and had not been raped by these black men. The sheriff immediately took the letter, made her sign a recantation saying, "I was drunk, I didn't mean this, I was raped." But by this time, the Communist Party got wind of what she had written, brought her north, and she became the darling of the Northern liberals. She was interviewed in mainstream papers, in left-wing papers. She went to a rally in Harlem where 6,000 people cheered her. She reenacted her testimony in Madison Square Garden. She led a march on Washington and went to the White House. Now, FDR would not receive the petition because he was just in office for 2 months at that time. He could not afford to alienate his Southern support. But she did see his right-hand man, Louis Howe, received her and the rest of them, and Vice President Garner, and she was riding high. She traveled the country with some of the Scottsboro mothers, and she raised a lot of money for the boys. And she was famous for a while, and she stuck to her story for a while, and we'll get to that too. But she was an interesting character. I mean, here's their semi-literate girl getting up and talking good communist slogans before thousands and thousands of people. The third quote, which begins the book, concerns the virulent anti-Semitism unleashed by the trial. Samuel Leibowitz, whom I mentioned, and all the other lawyers except one — and this is for the not the first round of trials, but the others — were Jews, and most of them were Northern Jews. In the South, this was an unholy alliance. I mean, the only thing worse than blacks was the combination of blacks and Jews together. So there were, as I said, many racial slurs, not racial, many anti-Semitic slurs, both in the courtroom, people shouting out. Outside the courtroom, they were chanting, first we lynched the blacks, they used the N-word, then we lynched the Jews. There was a pamphlet on sale in front of one of the courthouses saying, entitled, Kill the Jew from New York. The National Guard kept offering Samuel Liebowitz guards, security guards. He kept saying no, but Mayor LaGuardia sent down two detectives, and Liebowitz was a New Yorker, so he didn't turn them down. He liked his New York detectives. Liebowitz was not the most logical choice to defend these young men. He was a criminal lawyer who had made his reputation and his fortune defending Al Capone, Mad Dog Cole, people like that. He was a very flamboyant lawyer. He had wanted to be an actor in college, and some of his defenses are great. The Eskimo pie defense, the gefilte fish defense is my favorite, but we don't have time to go into that tonight. He was great. And he believed that he could persuade any jury. He thought juries are all the same all over the country, and all he had to do was go through his very, very skillful courtroom theatrics, and he could win them over. And he said that he had never seen a bad jury. He also arrived in Alabama saying, I have not come down here to change your way of life. Well, in fact, he had, and while he did not win the boys an acquittal at the trial, he did, in a sense, change the Southern way of life on the statute books, if not in practice, because he had laid a groundwork. He laid the groundwork during the trials for an appeal to the Supreme Court on the basis of the fact that there were no blacks on the jury. And he appealed this. The Alabama Supreme Court kept sustaining the convictions. Liebowitz appealed it to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. And as I said, he was a criminal lawyer. He had never argued before the Supreme Court before. And he knew that he had to keep himself in check, no gefilte fish defense, nothing like that, and just behave himself. But he just couldn't keep himself in check, and at one point he cried out that the jury books had been forged, and Chief Justice Charles Evan Hughes was appalled. This is not the kind of behavior we're accustomed to in the Supreme Court. And he said, can you prove that? And Liebowitz said, yes, I have the jury rolls here. Well, in fact, it's very, very rare for the Supreme Court to permit evidence because it's all constitutional law, but they did in this case. And the clerk carried in these huge, dusty jury books and gave them to the Chief Justice, and he looked at them and looked up. And Liebowitz, he didn't know how he was going to rule, but Liebowitz immediately knew that he had seen what he had seen. And they passed it all the way down one side of all the justices, and then the clerk carried around all the way the other. And it was evident that all the men had seen the same thing. What was done, what had been done in Alabama, is that a red line is drawn in the jury books to demarcate one time frame period from another. And they had squeezed in a bunch of black names of prospective jurors above the red line and even over the red line. So you could see that the black ink was on top of this red line. And he proved that, in fact, the jury book rolls had been forged. So the court ruled that the exclusion of blacks from jury rolls deprived defendants of their rights to equal protection under the law as guaranteed in the 14th Amendment. There's a wonderful anecdote that is so good it's probably apocryphal, but I love to tell it. A few years later, Liebowitz's wife convinced him to go to take a vacation. He loved his work. He wouldn't take a vacation. She got him down to Miami Beach. He lasted for about 24 hours and was so bored he went to the nearest courthouse. And the trial was not very interesting, but he was surprised that there was a black man on the jury, so he hung around, and afterward he went up to one of the local lawyers and said, I'm very surprised to see a black man on your jury. I didn't think you had them down here. And he said, the lawyer said, we never used to, but some smart Alec New York lawyer named Liebowitz went down to Alabama and argued the case all the way up to the Supreme Court, and now damned if we don't have to. As I said, it's too good to be true, but I hope it is. The Scottsboro case eventually became an albatross around Alabama's neck. They couldn't even get loans. So the state in 1936, for no reason at all, because all the boys were charged with the same crimes, freed four of the boys and kept five in prison. The lawyers immediately rushed the boys up here to New York. 2,000 people met them at Penn Station, cheered them. It was wonderful. Liebowitz said, we are going to get these boys a good... There will be no exploitation. We're going to get these boys a good education. We're going to get them good jobs. A month later, they were starring at the Apollo Theater. I've seen the placard. The Scottsboro Boys in person with an all-girl review, 50 fascinating females. So exploitation is not unique to our era. Unfortunately, the other five young men remained in jail. The negotiations for parole and everything, for parole dragged on. But the war came, and people's attention wandered, obviously, to other matters. And then post-war prosperity came, and the term the Scottsboro Boys kind of faded from memory. Then in 1976, NBC put on a docudrama, what we used to call a docudrama, based on the case. And at the end, a narrator said that the two Scottsboro girls, Ruby Bates and Victoria Price, were dead. Well, they weren't dead. They had married and changed their last names, obviously, and they'd also assumed different first names because who wanted to go through life as the Scottsboro girl? But they got wind of this, and they sued NBC. They were still poor. They were still angry. They were still, you know, the underclass of America, and it was a very sad story. And they sued NBC, and the man who had written a wonderful nonfiction account, Dan Carter, for several $1 million. And Ruby changed her story again. This was the fifth time she said, "I was raped on that train back in 1931. Ruby died before the case came to trial, and the judge fortunately dismissed Victoria Bates' suit. A few days later, Clarence Norris went down to Alabama to be pardoned by George Wallace. Afterward, asked by reporters if he was bitter, he said, "No, I'm just glad to be free," which I think is an amazing statement after all those years in jail. Now, as I said, I'm going to read for just a few minutes. I'll explain two things about the reading. I wrote the book mainly in the voice of two women, Ruby Bates, who is the semi-literate girl who keeps changing her story, and a fictional character based on two actual women who covered this, two reporters who covered the case. The reason I chose to make her a composite and a fictional character is the actual women had very exciting lives on their own. I mean, Mary Heaton Vorst covered many, many trials and good left-wing causes. And I wanted to stay with Scottsboro. I didn't want to go off to her marriages and that sort of thing. So this is a fictional character based on the two of them called Alice. And I will read the first part, which is from the introduction, the prologue, is the actual beginning of the book when they're on the train. The other caveat about my reading, I could not write this book without using the N-word. You can't write about Scottsboro without that word. I will not read that word, so I have changed it to blacks. If it sounds a little strange throughout, it just, I think, makes us all more comfortable. So, March 25th, 1931, an Alabama Great Southern freight train. I was happy that afternoon. Happy wasn't nothing usually gave me the time of day. Some folks said happy wasn't nothing I had a right to, on account of between being good and having a good time. I didn't see no contest. But I was happy in the freight car with the green haze of hickories and sweet gums chugging past and the sun trickling down and Victoria setting alongside. Victoria had a mean streak a mile wide. I'd be lying if I said different. But back when I first went into the mill, she was the only one who treated me halfway neighborly. She learned me how to spin and to mind myself around the machines that could take off a finger before you knew it and to keep a distance from the bosses who were fast with their hands when you weren't looking. Victoria had been around the block. And then they stop the train, they take the girls off, and the posse is questioning the two girls. "Now, I got one more question, ma'am," he said to Victoria, "and it ain't a hard one to figure. Did them blacks on the train interfere with you?" I knew what he meant by interfere, but I didn't figure the rest of what he was saying. Me and Victoria didn't have nothing to do with them colors on the train. "Of course they did," the man with the shotgun said. "They blacks, ain't they? They see it, they gotta have it." "I ain't talking to you, Horace. I'm asking the lady." I couldn't believe my own ears. Ma'am was nice, but lady was something Sunday special. "Did them blacks interfere with you?" the man asked again. Victoria licked her bee-sting lips. She looked the man right in the eye. I waited on her. She was good at making up stories. Practical jokes, too. But even Victoria wouldn't tell a lie about this. She knew what it meant for the blacks. Victoria's tongue went over her lips again. Her eyes slid to me, then away. "Them blacks raped me," she said. "They held a knife to my throat and raped me and my friend both." A murmur, almost like in church when the preacher says something good and the amens and the hallelujahs and the glory, glory, bless the Lord ring out, rose around us. I kicked and I screamed and I fought, but there was too many of them. Six raped me and the rest raped my friend, Victoria said. I still didn't believe my own ears. Victoria knew. She knew good as me. Better, maybe, what would happen. The man turned his hard white eyes on me. "That true, ma'am? Did those blacks rape you and your friend?" I tried to look at the man, but his eyes cut me like broken glass. I gazed yonder where they were tying the colored boys together with a rope, one after the other in a long line with their hands behind their backs. The man leaned down and put his face in front of mine. You just look at me, Missy, and don't pay no heed to them blacks. Now, it's an easy question. All you got to say is yes or no. Did them blacks rape you like they done to your friend? You tell like I tell it, Victoria had said. But if I told it like Victoria, them boys were good as dead. Maybe right now, maybe in a couple of weeks, maybe swinging from a tree, maybe in the electric chair, one way or another, they'd be dead. Only maybe they wouldn't. Maybe they would just go to jail. Maybe Victoria knew that. That was why she made up the story. Between me and her going to jail for riding the rails and crossing state lines with men ain't our kin and vagrancy and a bunch of blacks going, I didn't see no contest. I'm still waiting, sister. Besides, they were only blacks, probably used to jail, probably spent half their lives in jail and didn't mind it none, probably liked it. Lots of blacks did. Only way they got a roof over their heads and a decent meal, folks said. But it'd be different for me. It'd be worse for me than Victoria, even, on account of Victoria already laid out a sentence for adultering, but I never was in jail. And I wasn't fixing to start now just to save a bunch of blacks I never laid eyes on before a couple of hours back. Cat got her tongue, one of the men said. Else she's a black lover. Yeah, that's it. Had to rape one, but the other didn't put up no fight. Now I'm going to ask you one more time, sister, and this time I expect to answer. Victoria was staring the words at me. You tell it like I tell it. The gun was poking in my ribs. Folks wouldn't take my word against Victoria's anyhow. Not when Victoria was so smart and such a good talker, and I was the girl with the tongue the cat always got. I'm still waiting, the man said. Victoria stared knives at me. Yes or no, the man asked. Yes, I answered. And there started 50 years of injustice. The second segment I'd like to read is, it's in Alice's voice, but it's actually partly in the voice of one of the mothers of the nine young men. Several of the mothers traveled the country, as I said, raising funds and just support for their sons. And in the book, and they were interviewed, obviously, repeatedly, and in the book I have Alice interviewing Clarence Norris's mother. She told me about sharecropping in Georgia, moving from farm to farm in Warmsings and Molina and Neal. The white man gave them a home and so many acres of land to grow crops, mostly cotton. At the end of the year, the white man sold the crops and took out what he said they owed for seed and fertilizer and everything else he recollected giving them. Somehow, there was never much left. Life was hard, but she found cause to give thanks to the Lord. It did not seem fair to the Lord to recollect only the misery. But sometimes she just could not help herself from studying the misery, like the day each of her children put on the white sack. I asked her what the white sack was. I could not be sure, but it seemed to me her unhappy mouth turned up at the corners for a moment, and she shook her head back and forth in the wonder of it. A grown woman who had lived as long as I had did not know what the white sack was. Now that was being saved right here on earth. The white sack, she explained, was the bag you put the cotton in when you went up and down the rows picking. One by one, her young ones put it on at 5 or 6, or a little younger for the big boys. Willie, Clarence, Lucille, Blanche, Inez, Port, Ina May, Ida Bell, and Ebenezer slipped it around their necks like a noose. When the young ones started out with the white sack at dawn, it did not drag them down too much, and all they had to worry about was tripping over it, because it was 3 or 4 times as long as the littlest ones. But as the sun climbed higher over the fields, and the air began to boil, and their small hands bled from the picking, the sack filled up. A body would not think something light as cotton could weigh so heavy. More than once, the littlest ones stumbled and fell. But they learned, and if her heart broke watching them learn, she knew there were worse things. Even when the old white man with the pulpy red nose like a rotten apple came into the house while her husband was out in the fields and started in to bother her, she knew there were worse things. At least he fixed on her and didn't start in troubling the girls. Inez and Ida May were crying and screaming for their mama, but that was better than their mama crying and screaming for them. They couldn't have been older than 6 or 7, but that didn't make no difference to some white men, colored neither. She knew she was not beating the white man's game. There was no way a body could do that. But maybe if you were real careful, if you prayed hard and did as the white man and the white woman too said, if you didn't complain about the things the white man made you pay for that you never saw a shadow of and didn't answer back when the white woman took out of your pay for something you never broke, you could pass down the white man's road, which was the only road in this life, without too much misery. That was what she used to think. That was what she taught the young ones, because they were her first fear. There wasn't a morning she did not send one of them off, afraid he would not come home that night. There wasn't a white man passed she did not wish she had some magic she could throw over the girls to fool his eyes into not seeing them. And she was just beginning to think that maybe she would make it down the white man's road when she learned the truth. The neighbor's boy was named Ebenezer, just like her youngest. He was about 14 or 15, a dangerous age, especially if the boy was tall and well-made. Big boys got too big for their britches. They started in feeling their strength around men and their sex around women. Ebenezer was big, but not too big for his britches. His mom had taught him good. He took off his cap and bowed his head to the white man. You would not catch him on the same side of the road with a white woman. He said, sir and ma'am and mister. That was the trouble. One morning he walked into the store where they went to get cheated and said, good morning, Mr. Jack, sir. Real polite, the way his mama taught him to. But Mr. Jack did not like a big, strapping colored boy playing fast and loose with his Christian name. He took the gun he kept behind the counter and shot Ebenezer dead. When they carried the body of that hat-doffing, careful-talking boy home, Ida Norris knew that someday she would be here begging for one of her boys, if she was lucky enough to have a chance to beg. And that story did not happen in connection with the Scottsboro Boys, but it's one of the thousands and thousands of horror stories you read when you begin to do this research. So thank you all, and if you have questions or comments or anything like that, yes?
This was around the time Jesse Owens also stopped the sharecropper family, made his fortune. Did that come into the picture in your research at all?
No, that's interesting. Not at all.
It was definitely some sharecroppers.
Yeah. Yeah.
This whole sharecropping thing that recently has been said is a very, very big issue in the continuation of that slavery issue. So this is a good thing for now.
Yeah, I was shocked. I've just been in the South off and on for 2 weeks, and I was shocked at how many people don't know about this, especially young students. You know, they have no idea. This is not anything that's taught down there, or up here for that matter. Yeah. Yes?
I'll ask you a technical question about legal and defense. Ordinarily, a lawyer, in order to try a case in another state, is sort of sponsored or associated with a local lawyer and admitted to the bar of Alabama for the purpose of trying the case. Did Leibowitz have any difficulty in finding a local work with him?
No, that's an interesting question. As I said, there was one lawyer who was not a Jew, and he was an Alabama lawyer. He was a very interesting character. He had defended a couple of communists in the South, and he, by his defense, had something to do with the fact that, well, all of your ancestors were traitors to the United States too, because of course they were all in the Confederacy. But he also wrote a paper or something like that defending lynching in certain instances. So he was a strange character. There's a scene from the trial that I use in the book because I think it tells someone. I used a lot of the trial testimony to write the scenes of the trial, and the audience or the people in the courtroom are shouting, you know, hissing and yelling, you know, get the Jew or get the black or something like this. And Leibowitz jumps up and says, you know, this is disgraceful. I declare, you know, I ask for a mistrial. I'm not a lawyer and I get my terminology wrong. This sort of thing. And this judge this lawyer who's one of the defense lawyers stands up and says, I beg your pardon, Honor, this is just the way of Southern men. They don't mean nothing by it. And Leibowitz looked at him as if, is he on my side or the other one's side? You know, it was very, very interesting. Yes. That's an interesting question. In the beginning, the NAACP, when they were still thinking they might defend the boys, approached Darrow. Darrow decided not to take the case. It's not entirely clear to me why. I mean, he kept saying he was retiring, but he always said that. At just about the same time, he took a similar case, but on the other side. It was the Massey case in Hawaii, and her mother, this was a young girl who claimed she was raped by some Hawaiians of color. And she was probably having an affair with, she was married to a Navy officer, but we won't go into that. And when the accused rapists were declared innocent, or found not guilty, rather, her mother shot one of them, this delightful society lady, who was, in fact, I believe, divorced from Eleanor Roosevelt's uncle or something like this. It's all very complex. But here she was, and she shot this young Hawaiian man, and she went on trial. And Darrow defended her at the same time that this was going on, which is an interesting choice on his part. Yeah. No, it's University in Atlanta, and I'm sorry. Yeah, I did the research a while ago. I can't remember the name of the university, but yeah. I wasn't talking to a lot of people. There are not that many people alive who were involved. A lot of newspapers of the period, both Northern and Southern and Black, and a lot of first-person accounts. I mean, this case was covered. People were writing about what they saw. The Times coverage by a man named Raymond Daniels was quite good. And as I said, I saw the Southern newspapers. And there were just personal accounts. It was a major part. I mean, a decade earlier, there had been Sacco and Vanzetti. And then the Scottsboro case. This was one of the reasons I think that they became known as the Scottsboro Boys was, you know, there were nine names. They did not even print the nine names when these young men were arrested. Not for a long time did they. But when they chose the white jurors, they printed all of their names in the paper and their occupations. But of course, you know, the Southern, they were Scottsboro, so it was a rallying cry. And they were boys because they were blacks. And just as in the Constitution, or not the Constitution, but in the original Constitutional Convention, blacks were 3/5 of a white man. Here they were boys and not full men. I mean, they were young men, but that's not why they used the term boys. So, but you could not carry nine names on a placard, so they had the Scottsboro Boys. And as I said, this was a really, you know, pivotal moment for many, many left-wing people at the time, so there are a lot of first-person accounts. Yes? Oh yeah, they tried. First of all, they raised money to hire the first lawyer, the drunken lawyer who knew no law. They were on the road doing their best to raise money. It was, the NAACP did not want to get involved in this case in the beginning. For one thing, they thought there probably was a rape, and they didn't want to dirty their coattails. They had fought too hard to make advances. I'm not criticizing them. They had fought so hard to make the small advances they had. You've got Walter White, who's the head of the NAACP, who looks like a white man and is traveling in the South as a white man often, and therefore risking his life. But they didn't like this case. It wasn't what they wanted to fight for. And they were all middle-class preachers, lawyers, teachers, doctors in the NAACP. These were very, most of the young men couldn't read. They were illiterate. They were illiterate when they went out. Many of them could read when they went into jail. When they came out, many of them had learned to read. So they didn't want to defend these young men, but they knew they'd lose their credibility if they didn't. What happened was they got into a contest with the Communist Party, because both groups, the NAACP and the Communist Party, said, we won't break up the boys, to the nine young men. You take one of us or the other, but you know, you can't pick and choose. And the Communists were smart. They went down and they shook hands with the boys and said, hi, I'm Al and I'm here to defend you. And also sent them money and didn't ask, not much, but you know, a few dollars here and there, and didn't ask what the money was for. If they wanted to spend it to bribe a jailer to get a woman for the night, that was okay with the Communist Party. They knew what they were doing. The NAACP was horrified, and they told them that they told the young men to just behave themselves, don't make trouble, we're making progress. And the reason I go through all this is there's a very damning letter from an NAACP regional director to Walter White saying, the parents of the boys are among the densest and dumbest animals I have ever seen. And so there was a lot of prejudice within the black, I don't like to say community, because that suggests that they were all of one mind, and they weren't. Yes? Yeah. One of the things, I'm a firm believer that, this is a circuitous way to the answer, I'm a firm believer as a novelist, you know what you're going to write as far as plot and characters in the story. You don't know, I think, until you're well into the book, what your real motivations are. And what I discovered with writing this book is that I really wanted to look at what makes a white liberal, and why do they do what they do, and the good they do, and the harm they cause inadvertently. And like many journalists, this my fictional reporter is doing a lot of good. She's really working hard to save these boys and to help Ruby, but she's making quite a career out of it. And that was why, I mean, at the period, a woman journalist would have been mixed up with Eleanor Roosevelt. So that's why I chose that. Yes. The surprises were just what I said about not knowing. I thought I knew about Scottsboro. I didn't know half of the things that had been going on. The difficulties, I didn't know that the two women characters and their relationship, which was, you know, very class antagonistic, was going to absorb me the way it did. The two of them took over, and I started out without any point, without Ruby, any point of view from Ruby, the girl who keeps changing her story. She was seen from a distance. Then I said, no, I got to get her point of view. And then I said, I have to write in her voice. And I said, I can't write in her voice. I'm a New York woman. I can't write this semi-literate Southern voice. And I kept at it. And once I started, I couldn't stop. And that was the difficulty, but also one of the great joys. And apparently, according to my favorite quote that compares her to a Faulkner character, you know, I'm so glad I struggled with it. But it's, and once you start to do that, it takes over more and more. So during the time, I was speaking pretty strangely myself when I left the library. Yeah, Jim. That's an interesting question. There's a problem for real historians. They always look at me askance, and I have to with each book. It's a new group of historians, specialists, and I have to earn my, you know, I have to earn respect. No, I'm not going to change this story. You know, with Lucy, I'm not going to make her daughter FDR's illegitimate daughter. That kind of stuff. You have to prove that you have good intentions here. There are two excellent nonfiction accounts of this book, but mainly, I wanted to write it. I'm a novelist, and what I'm interested in is these monumental events of the era. Like as Sarah said, my last one was about the aftermath of the Holocaust in this country. I want to address these issues, but I want to address them in human terms. And I didn't find anything new about the Scottsboro Boys, but I tried to get into the heads of these various characters and what it meant to them at the time, and that's what really fascinates me. I mean, you're given the plot. You cannot change what the character does, so all you can do is try to go deeper and deeper into that character and figure out why did that character do that, and that, for me, is the most thrilling thing. Yeah? Okay.
Well,
That's an interesting comment, too, or question. I have to be careful, because you saw the way I was starting to go, as if I'm so disapproving. Well, it's easy for me to be disapproving. I mean, Walter White and the rest of them were doing wonderful things, and for me to stand back and judge is not exactly fair. I do wish, you know, I have hindsight, and I guess it's the same answer. I can understand what they were doing. You know, the instinct, the knee-jerk liberal instinct is, what's wrong with the NAACP? And then you think, these are human beings, and they're, you know, they're just trying to navigate a course. So, yes. Yeah, he was around, and they all supported it. He did not get, I haven't come across anything in particular that he did. When you read accounts and you see the letters, the Schoenberg Library up here in Harlem has a wonderful collection on all of this. And so you see the letters from Dreiser and reports from the party and stuff like this, and he didn't figure much, which is not to say he was not active. And the ACLU papers are at Princeton, and they have a lot on this as well. Yeah. Yeah, it did. I mean, Leibowitz was virulently anti-communist, And he made the Communist Party promise that they would not interfere with his defense of the case. The amazing thing is that a man as worldly as he was believed them when they said they wouldn't, because in fact they did. They probably bribed Ruby. And they tried to bribe Victoria, and Victoria was too smart for them and turned the tables on them. Ruby, I didn't mention that. She probably had some financial incentive as well. Okay, well, thank you all very, very much for coming.
I thought I was going to come in for part of it at least. When did she start?
6:30.
Uh huh.
Yeah. So.
Oh, well.
50 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't want to.
I have to say there was fabulous questions.
Yeah, they were very good.
I read somewhere that Barbara Tuchman had the same problem with historians that you did.
Yeah, it's interesting. Once you kind of prove yourself, they couldn't be nicer and more helpful, but in the beginning you kind of get, it's very interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
And my father, I was born in Memphis, and he was defending the rights of the blacks to use the Greyhound.
Oh, that's fascinating, yeah.